But see, this is the problem with, let's say, market-driven capitalism that's just blindly following the pursuit of value extraction. It doesn't really pay attention to society. And so we have problems like the environment. I mean, in our book, we basically say there are three major problems that can't be solved by governments alone. The environment, income inequality, and population control.
Thanks for downloading. This is Christopher Lockhead, Follow Your Different, where we aspire to have real dialogues, not BS interviews, with amazing people who are making the world a different place. As always, we are sponsored by our friends at NetSuite from Oracle. Learn how to turbocharge the growth of your business today at netsuite.com/different. On this episode, we hang out with my buddy, entrepreneur, best-selling author, activist, executive editor of the Marketing Journal, none other than the legendary Christian Sarkar. He is a smart, provocative thinker. We have a fun, far-ranging conversation. It's this one's a little like ADHD theater, maybe even more than normal. On this episode with Christian, you will learn what brand activism is, why business leaders need to embrace social causes and do more than just make money, how you can build a legendary company and make a difference in the world at the same time, and a whole lot more. Go to lockhead.com to check out the show notes for this episode, the key takeaways. Now, hey-ho, let's go.
If you look at some of the greatest bands, Rolling Stones, for example, and then, of course, I'll bring in Steel Pulse, they've got lifetime members, you know, who are part of the fan base. Yes. Who are literally well known. The band knows them by name. They know their lives. They're personal friends. And whenever, let's say, the Rolling Stones go on tour, these, you know, let's say 500 of these fans will sort of follow them across the world.
And actually, you should get him to write for you guys. My buddy Eddie Yoon wrote this book called Super Consumers.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of this.
I think he's a freaking genius. I love the guy. He's been incredibly helpful to me in my thinking, and he helped with both of my books.
Well, connect us. I'll be happy to have him write for us. I mean, are you kidding? Of course.
Yeah, and his whole premise in Super Consumers is exactly what you're talking about, which is you want to identify those types of people and focus on them and kind of build out from there. And that's how categories and brands, and, you know, he's got a whole set of thinking around it. I'll make the intro. You'll love him. But yeah, it's exactly that.
So let's use that idea, which is these are the progressive users. You know, these are the, let's say, the cutting edge fans who are, you know, who want, you know, if you have seven versions of a song, they're going to listen to all seven versions over and over again. You know, that's, you know, in fact, I was talking to David Hines about how they could put out one song that they wrote maybe, you know, 30 years ago, but they could put out 20 versions of that that have been recorded and make that just one release. You know, one product is 30 versions of that song.
The same song.
Over the last 30 years.
You know, it's funny you say that because I like Pearl Jam. I'm not a mega crazy Pearl Jam. Like I have a good friend, Skip, who's like a mega crazy, you know, he chases them all around Europe and does all this. But so I like them, but I'm not at that level. But that said, they have this song called Yellow Ledbetter, and the guitar lick in it, I think, is one of the greatest guitar licks of all time.
Yeah.
And, you know, Eddie's voice.
I'm going to have to pay attention to that. Okay,
and the band, it's called Yellow Ledbetter. Rarely do I love the studio version and the live version the same. And in the live version, it's a little longer. The solo's a little different. The lick is even slightly different. That, you know, they sort of play with the song a little, but they don't they don't fuck it up. I hate when, you know, the melody is different.
Yeah, they overdo it. Yeah,
right. They over fuck with it. Right. So they just they just fuck with it enough. Anyway, and I have often thought I can't figure out which one I love more.
Yeah. In fact, if you listen to B.B. King, there's a great interview that he did. And, you know, I love B.B. King for, I mean, it's sort of, he's always been in the background of all of this stuff. You know, as I like all these different bands, there's always, you know, the blues and the bait at the bottom of the pyramid, you know, sort of the foundation. And, you know, I saw B.B. King on his last tour right before he passed away. And, you know, they wheel him on, you know, to the side of the stage in a wheelchair. He gets up, walks to his chair, sits down, and then plays. And you know, and you can tell he, it's hard work for him, right? But then what he says is, but then he plays that Thrill Is Gone song, right? Which is sort of his bread and butter. And there was an interview that he did where he said that, you know, I try to play that song every time as if I'm playing it for the first time. And I have right now 17 versions of The Thrill Is Gone on my playlist. And I swear to you, each one of them is really different. Now, the basic arrangement is the same. The chord structure is the same. But even the actual licks that he does, he'll change it around. And it's beautiful to hear them one after the other because they're so different. The speed, the velocity of the thing, the, how he hits the notes, and even how he sings it is different.
I love it.
And you know, this is a simple song. It's a very basic song. And when you see sort of people who copy it, they copy, you know, one version, which is sort of the probably his, you know, album version, the, you know, the basic one.
The main version.
That's the one they copy.
But you know, the other thing I love about him, he is the only guy I can think of in music history who was smart enough to name his guitar. Right? His guitar is named Lucille, right?
That's right.
And I'm just checking right now if you can still buy a Lucille, a brand new one. Yeah, there it is. It's on Epiphone.com right now.
Right.
We can buy a Lucille. And so, first of all, of course, Lucille is a gorgeous Gibson / Epiphone guitar. But because he named it, and of course, it has a very distinct look. But if you think about Slash by way of example, or Eddie Van Halen, you know, guys who play iconic guitars, you know, but they didn't name them.
And that's genius marketing is what that is.
Right? You got to love that.
And it also goes back to that idea that, you know, that instrument is really your partner for life. And if you look at these sports kids, right, they sleep with the basketball. They'll sleep with the soccer ball. You know, they'll take it, you know, and everywhere they go, they've got the ball with them. So this is what even Janelle Monáe, you know, the musician, I think she just won Album of the Year from Rolling Stone or something. But she would walk around with her guitar everywhere she went, in college, outside college. You know, wherever you go, you have the guitar kind of slung around your neck.
Well, and what I love about that, there's a childlike thing about that, you know, to your point, when you're a kid and you get your first, you know, real baseball glove or soccer ball or whatever your thing is, or guitar for that matter, and you can't, it's always with you and you're always dribbling or you're always throwing a baseball into the glove or whatever it is,
right?
Yeah, there's something.
So where has that gone for our kids, and what can marketers learn in terms of doing something like that where your product becomes a part of their life, right?
This they're sort of too the busy job. Playing, is it Fortnite?
That's right.
Is that what it is? I don't know shit about that stuff.
Yeah, but. Well, I'll tell you, I don't know. I have never played it, but I do know what the big controversy is, if you want to know what the latest controversy on Fortnite is.
Yes, I want to know.
It has to do with appropriation. So, you know, after you shoot somebody in Fortnite and you celebrate, you do these different dances. And the dances that they do are actually stolen from these hip hop guys.
I now that you say it, it's triggering in my whiskey stained brain here. Yes, and isn't one of these sort of street dancer, hip hop dancer type guys suing them because
getting
they stole
ready to
a
sue
dance
them.
Move?
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. There's this, you know, and one of them did sue them, which is that Carlton guy. You know, in what's that? The thing that Will Smith did. You know, the Prince of Bel-Air. Remember, he had a Carlton dance. So that dance has been sort of appropriated. But there's about, and the problem here
can
is.
Can you trademark a dance move? I guess that's the question.
And that's part of the problem, which is the copyright for dance moves. And I was studying this today for some reason. Okay, don't ask me why.
You were studying copyright of dance
moves? On dance moves, if that's actually possible. Because, you know, I was just reading up on this. And it turns out, this is how I spend my morning, you know, But it turns out you cannot actually copyright the specific dance moves, because that supposedly, if you want to build something new on that, you're restricting the creativity of future dance moves by copywriting these little things. However, if you have a whole choreographed show, like from end to end, that can be, you know, copyrighted apparently as a work of art or something.
Now, here's the interesting thing then. So you saw that fairly recently, Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams were lost their lawsuit, and they now have to pay $5 million to Marvin Gaye's family.
That's right.
For Blurred Lines. And the estate gets 50% of ongoing royalties. And so, and then of course there's the one, and I think it's going to go through round two, if I'm not mistaken, the lawsuit around Stairway to Heaven.
To Heaven, I was just going to bring that up. Yeah. And it does sound quite similar, you know, the chord progression and everything with that one.
Well, and especially when you consider, I forget the name of the band, but that wrote the original.
That they were touring with them. Yeah.
Right. You're like, well, this ain't a coinky dink.
Yeah.
Now it is different. There are some moves in it that are different, but it is very similar. But yeah, I don't know how you can own that stuff. It's a very interesting artistic dilemma.
Right. And if you really look at what artists do, and this is going back to art, you know, most artists will copy other people's works as part of their learning process, you know? So you learn to paint like, you know, you copy Leonardo, you copy the masters so you can learn what they did. And then eventually you come out with your own vocabulary and your own style and your own, you know, there is no other Mark Knopfler, right? But Mark Knopfler learned from somewhere, and his influences were people like Chet Atkins, you know, which is amazing if you think about it.
By the way, if you Google it, you'll find this, Christian. It's one of the coolest things I've ever heard. I don't know who put it out, but out on the internet, you will find his lead guitar line only from Sultans of Swing. Have you heard it with no band? Have you heard this?
No, but I've heard many versions of Sultans of Swing, you know. So
it's just the guitar track. So it's the original guitar track, including the solo.
Yeah.
And when you hear it by itself, it, at least for me, I'm like knocked over how legendary Mark Knopfler is.
Right. If you've seen that soundtrack of Local Hero, it's the same thing, you know, because he... And that's what he was. He was very good at, he was a great composer. And he did a lot of soundtracks as well. So there's a lot there.
And his work with Emmylou Harris, oh my God.
Right. And
now, the interesting thing on all this suing business, you know, I remember when the song's called Danny California. It's a Red Hot Chili Peppers song. It's a great song, Danny California. And it, the sort of the rhythm guitar track and sort of the foundation of the song sounds a lot like Tom Petty's Last Dance with Mary Jane.
Wow.
And I think the chord progression is, if it's not identical, it's really close. I mean, it's you can hear it, right? And I remember Danny California was a pretty decent size hit, I think, for the Chili Peppers. Anyway, I remember reading an interview with Tom Petty, and sort of saying, you know, are you going to sue these guys over it? And he's like, look, there's like six chords, man. Like, I'm not going to sue these guys. Like, I don't need their, like, I like the song. Have at it. And the other story that to me is along those lines, and you can go and read about it on the internet. Eddie Van Halen has talked about it a lot. Of course, he played the lead guitar on Beat It.
Right.
Which is one of the biggest singles of all time.
Right, it was 3 minutes, right? He came in and did it, and that was it.
And that was it.
Yeah.
And I guess, I forget the exact story, but, you know, he gets contacted, says, hey, you want to do this? He says, sure. They never talk about economics. He comes down to the studio, listens to it, does his thing, and walks out. And he's never been paid a dime for it, never asked for it. Right. He's like, I don't give a shit. It was very, like...
Right.
Michael Jackson was totally cool, and I wanted to be on the record, and I don't give a shit. And so... On one hand, you know, I don't know where the line is, you know, on one hand as an artist.
Well, I think it comes down to respect. And this is what the rapper guy was talking about. There's a Millie Rock rapper guy who was talking about the dance appropriation. What he said, what he would have liked is when you download that dance in Fortnite, why not have an attribution to where that dance came from and have that song that he promoted, you know, the song with the dance and the video and everything, so that users can see where it came from.
Yes.
And maybe give them a small cut, a percentage of what they, when they sell that dance move, because they're actually making money off that dance move, right?
Right.
They're not just giving it to you for free as part of the game. It's you know, you have to buy that separately.
Well, and I think this is cool in publishing, you know, as an author, and I didn't know this in the beginning, but, you know, I can quote Eddie Yoon's book, Super Consumers, in my next book. I don't have to ask for permission. I don't have to do any of that stuff. The quote has to be accurate, and it has to be attributed appropriately, and footnoted and all that good stuff.
Right.
And if you do that, then it's not plagiarism.
It's academic use, right.
It's academic use. And even though theoretically, you know, I'm quote unquote making money off of, because I'm selling my book.
Right.
And, but the reality is that to me is totally cool. And we've now had a handful of books come out and reference either Play Bigger or Niche Down. And I think it's great. And, you know, it's an interesting thing. I think you're right. If you're being cool about it.
It goes back to the IP world of how IP is structured as a sort of lawyerly game. It goes back to extracting value from intellectual property and how you do that. And, you know, the open source world is diametrically opposed to that, right? It's basically the same with creative, what's it called? Creative Commons. It's all about sharing. You just have to attribute it, maybe point to where the source is, and you can have different types of, you can have commercial use, you know, which is free, or you can have it where you can, for non-commercial use, it's free. Otherwise, if you do use it for commercial use, then you have to, you know, get a separate copyright. So this, you know, this is it's sort of a free for all. And that's part of this problem now, is that the world is changing so fast and so rapidly that we can't keep up. Governments certainly can't keep up with any of this. So then who's going to manage this? You know, we have gene editing going on where these kids are being born in China, where that guy was doing his gene splicing on a baby, right? And
I heard this recently.
Yeah, this just happened.
It just happened. But remember, he was trying to make them immune from AIDS?
I don't know if that's what he was doing. I don't know what he was doing, but he was doing something. Yeah.
I think that's what it was. And the kids were twins. Hold on, we can find it out here, but I'm pretty sure they're now saying it looks like one of the twins is fucked up. Like one, it didn't work in one of the twins. I swear I read that.
Right. Oh God. Yeah. So the question is, who regulates, who creates the rules? How do you create? So the truth is, we're at a point where governments are failing us. They're not able to control sort of, you know, there's no rules, right? I mean, you wake up one morning and the air's black, you know, and that's it. And somebody, you know, did something in their factory and basically turned your entire city into black air. Well, what do you do then? Well, there's got to be some way of regulating, and capitalism has not really had that guardrail for a long time. I mean, and you know, we know that in the roaring 20s and the Gilded Age, there was no rail. And then we brought the rail in, you know, after the Depression, we had all these laws that sort of, you know, made some kind of structure and said, you know, we have free markets, but they have rules. You can't just cheat and bribe and do all these other things. You have rules. You play by some kind of a set, you know, agreed upon norms. Well, that's the problem right now, is we have, you know, the major problems of the world are not being addressed by anyone. And there are a few regressive brands that are actually making sure it stays that way.
So like the cigarette companies in the old days when they claimed that cigarettes weren't bad for you, right?
Exactly. And, you know, you could even say Silicon Valley has a big problem now with, you know, with the disaster sort of thing with Facebook sharing its information, our private messages with Amazon and Netflix and everyone else.
That was a stunner, was it not?
Right. It was.
And the other thing that's terrifying about that is, you know, when Zuckerberg testified in front of Congress, he said, we don't sell the data.
Right.
And that apparently is a factually correct statement because they gave the data away. But I don't know if you've heard this expression. I think it's a powerful one. How to lie with the truth. Right? So he was factually correct if they didn't assuming that's true, I don't know shit from Shinola about it, but if that was true, that they gave it away, they didn't sell it, it was factually correct, his statement in front of Congress, but in the context of the question, it's a lie.
Right. Well, there's a funny quote that I have in my art, which says, if you tell the truth, you only have to lie once. Which is to say, you know, we aren't certain about our truths. And that truth maybe, and this is again the absolute versus relative truth, but it also depends on the view that you have of the truth. Because, you know, it's that old story of the elephant, you know, the blind, you know, the four blind people touching the elephant, one at each end, and each one has a different story of what the elephant is.
Yeah, that's right. And who is it? I'm just looking it up. It was Thomas Keita who said, "Don't believe everything you think." He's got a book called "Don't Believe Everything You Think." And I think that's really interesting. I find as I've lived on the planet longer, Christian, when somebody has a diametrically opposed position on something, whatever the something is to mine, my reaction is more curiosity.
Right.
When I was a younger man, it was more go fuck yourself.
Right.
Well, but now I'm really curious. Okay, so why do you think that?
Yeah. Yeah. And part of this is you're a respectful person and you're actually curious intellectually about what makes the other person tick.
Yes.
But when you're driven by ideology, you can't change your mind and everything else that doesn't fit in with your world is wrong.
Yes. Another one of my favorite quotes is, if you haven't changed your mind lately, how do you know you have one? I think about myself and I think, you know, there are things I believed 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago that I either don't believe or I have a much evolved, is the term we hear today, view on the thing.
You're more calm about things too. But see, this is the problem with, let's say, market-driven capitalism that's just blindly following the pursuit of value extraction. It doesn't really pay attention to society. And so we have, you know, problems like the environment. I mean, in our book, we basically say there are three major problems that can't be solved by governments alone. The environment, income inequality, and population control. And population control is sort of the forgotten problem that people have kind of conveniently forgotten about, but it hasn't gone away. And these three wicked problems taken together are basically the end of the planet. And if we aren't, and it's pretty much almost too late if you want to, you know, be blunt about it. So the question
is, your book is really a call to action for companies to.
It is. It's basically saying, from purpose, you know, you can say, hey, we're a purpose-based company. We're saying that's good, but you need to act. Because by not acting, you're not saving anybody. You're not going to have a business, for example. I mean, if you really think about ExxonMobil, the irony of it all is they're asking for protection from the ocean and the hurricanes that are smashing into their refineries, which are caused by climate change. They're asking for money from the government to build these levees and, you know, walls and stuff to protect them from the sea. But really, they're the ones who caused that by denying climate change in the first place. And they knew all about it. So it wasn't like an ignorant thing. It was a planned strategy. And even today, I mean, like last week in the New York Times, one of the cover stories was Marathon Oil basically lobbying and using Facebook techniques very similar to the Russian guys to basically influence Congress to reduce the emissions controls on cars and change the law there.
Yeah.
So those are what we call regressive brand activists. They're doing stuff which isn't, and you know, you go, hey, what's regressive? What's progressive? How do you define that? And that's what we come to in this book, because there are many approaches. I don't know if you saw the latest Forbes magazine has a thing called Just Capital has done what are the top just companies in the world, the companies that care about justice, and they have, you know, and how do they measure that? Well, they poll people. They ask people, hey, in your Americans, what do you say are the most important issues that companies should be worried about? And of course, top of the line is treat your employees fairly and properly, and you know, that's one of them. And they've got like seven of these dimensions: leadership, blah blah blah. And it's a very powerful index.
Christian, why is it so hard for so many of these companies to do the right thing? You know,
We don't teach that at business school. You know what we teach at business school? Maximize shareholder value.
But like, if you look at some company, I'll pick on one, Wells Fargo.
Sure.
You know, they have been caught over and over and over again fucking over their customers, and almost nothing happens.
Right.
You look at what just happened with Marriott Starwood, right? They had one of the most massive data breaches in modern history.
Nothing happens, right?
Nothing. Well, you know what they're doing? Here's what they're doing. They are offering people 1 year of monitoring on the internet.
Wow.
It's like, what the fuck? Are you kidding? You guys need to go to jail.
Right. Yeah. And part of that is that we have created a culture of governance that is very weak and by design has no teeth. So, you know, the banks that messed us up in 2008 with the financial crisis are doing the same thing again.
All over
and
again.
We're just getting ready for another crash right now. And this time we probably won't have the
money.
You
really think there's a crash coming?
I think there is because of this. It's the same response and maybe the different factors. You know, there's college debt. There's all these other issues that are part of this. But, you know, and that's why we have this revolt, if you will, in Europe right now, which, you know, the yellow jacket thing. I don't know if you've been watching that.
As a matter of fact, the second it started, it's funny you say this, Christian. I tweeted it out and I said, we all need to pay attention to this.
Right. It is.
Because
it's
remember
a big
when
deal.
The Brexit thing was going on?
Yes.
Americans didn't pay attention. It's like, no.
Right.
The some of this thinking is here in America. We live in a global world. We need to pay attention. And if Macron can go from, you know, getting elected and being viewed very positively to having a gas tax essentially put his government on the brink of collapse.
Collapse.
In
right.
a matter of, I don't know, I didn't watch it.
Days, yeah.
Right? I mean, in 1 week, he was in deep shit.
Right, and he still is.
And then you look at what's going on with May in the UK and trying to negotiate Brexit. And, you know, you could have, I don't know if it's going to happen, and I don't want to, you know.
Right.
But who knows what could go down. And so shit is fragile.
Right. And what we're doing now is in this book, the first part of the book is about how we've broken our trust in every institution there is. You know, the trust gap between, you know, where we don't trust our politicians, we don't trust our CEOs, we don't trust our religious institutions, we don't trust anybody. In fact, they've all let us down. So the question then becomes, how do you gain that trust back? What are the things, what are the companies that are actually the, you know, these, you know, like your friend, Mr. Eddie Yoon is going to say, Who are the companies with the super conscience? The companies that actually have a conscience, these ones, instead of a super consumer, these are the brand activists. And we're calling them progressive brand activists. So I'll give you an example. Just happened just a few weeks ago. So you know how everybody got a tax cut back, you know, when Trump cut taxes for these corporations, what did they use the money for? They used it to do stock buybacks. You know what Patagonia used that money for? Listen to this. Patagonia, and I'm pulling it up because I think it's pretty impressive. Patagonia actually took the money that they have, they got. And
from the tax break.
The tax cut that they got, and they gave it to companies protecting planet Earth.
Yeah.
So they actually invested that money into something for the long haul, you know?
Yeah.
And so we've
but
got...
why don't we have more... Look, and I think Yvon Chouinard... He's one of my heroes.
Yes, yes.
I have a buddy, Jeff Denham. He's actually been on the podcast a couple times. He's a Patagonia ambassador, sponsored athlete, a big
Love
wave
it.
Athlete. He's an incredible guy. Anyway, and he knows Yvon. Yvon's always been one of my heroes, and when he shares stories with me about him, it bolsters my opinion of him. And so, why don't we have more Yvon Chouinard?
Because it's much easier to do the other thing and make your money and run off to Switzerland, or like the hedge fund guys have done. We talked about this before. They've got their runways sitting there where they bought all these properties in New Zealand, and they think they're going to escape sort of the destruction of what they've caused by running off to New Zealand and living there, or Switzerland, or wherever it is, their safe haven that they want to live in. So what's
the other guy we have, and I don't know that it's at the same level, but I think you got to praise him. Here in Silicon Valley is Marc Benioff.
Yes. In fact, right? He is in the book. We have a whole section about the CEO as an activist. And there's a club, if you will. And Mark Benioff is part of that club of progressive CEOs. And, you know, the other people that are in that club are people like Richard Branson, you know, Indira Nooyi from, you know, Pepsi. She's just left Pepsi, of course. But
yeah,
there's a club of progressive CEOs who are saying we need to work together. We need to work together.
This is something I'd be curious to your reaction about this, Christian.
Yeah.
A lot of people like to shit on the millennials. And, you know, I have given them a whack from time to time myself.
Right.
However, what I see in millennial entrepreneurs is a mindset around this, which is, you may have heard this term. I love this term. And we had her on the podcast, Nancy Fund, who's the she's the original seed investor in Tesla and in SolarCity. She's been partnered with Elon for a very long time. Her firm, her venture firm, is called Double Bottom Line Partners.
Yes, I love
it. And this idea that we have a profit-making bottom line, and we have a, I'm paraphrasing, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but a making a difference bottom line. And we're going to measure both.
Right.
We're going to hold ourselves.
The guy who invented that is a guy named John Elkington, and he's got, he called it the triple bottom line. And he's in the book. We interview him. See, the other thing we have in the book, we interview about 9 people right now, but it's actually about 13 people. See, so here's the other thing I'll tell you that's funny about the book. So we did the ebook version, right? And then as soon as we put it out there, we go, well, there's all this other stuff we didn't do that we forgot to put in, right? Which is normally happens. And either you write another book or you go, well, with this version, the way we did this is we said, well, we've got this gap time between the print and the ebook, so we're going to actually change the book. The print version is going to have a couple of extra chapters, maybe 4 or 5 more interviews, new stuff. And then we're going to retro sort of update the Kindle version, you know, the ebook version.
It's like, to bring it back to music, it's like Kiss Alive and Kiss Alive 2. Go on, that was pretty quick, right?
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. And I even interviewed David Hines and another artist, a Native American artist, about what he thinks about what brands should be doing in terms of responsibility to the planet. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff here in terms of, we've got the guy, you know, Raj Sisodia, the guy who invented conscious capitalism. We have an interview with him. We have Stephen Covey Jr. We have an interview with him about trust and how that's the failure of trust in public institutions. So, you know, we're not trying to present answers in this book so much as we are trying to show what some companies are doing to get ahead of this and leading the way. These are the, you know, the, I would say the progressive brand activists, what they're doing. And here's the other thing. You can be progressive in one area and regressive in another. So,
yes.
For example, let's say your company is fighting for equal rights and doing all kinds of sponsoring athletes who are, you know, standing up for justice and stuff. And on the back end in your own company, you're sort of have a gender issue where you're, you know, discriminating against women.
Yes.
So,
there's,
you know,
an old Zen saying that says, what we do in one part of our life is what we do in all parts
exactly.
of our life.
So
right?
That's part of this, you know, because of transparency, companies are going to be held accountable.
Yes.
And we've identified like 6 dimensions. So you have social activism, which includes things like equality, gender equality, age discrimination, LGBT stuff, race, all of those equality issues, right?
So before you get to the other yeah. 5, on the social yeah. one, here's my question for you.
Yeah.
When do you think we get to a point where this is like a duh, like a no shit Sherlock, like this isn't even a conversation anymore? Of course this is what you do.
Right. Well, the social thing is obviously something that all brands need to do. It's not based on an industry. It's a universal human rights thing. So this is what comes back to the fact that, you know, when the U.S. decides that it's not going to be part of the Human Rights Commission with the U.N., we're actually signaling to not just our companies, but also to foreign governments that the U.S. is no longer actually interested in human rights. And the baseline for any kind of equality, any kind of sort of justice is human rights. And if you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that's what it is.
We've been lucky enough to have four-star General Stanley McChrystal on the podcast twice. He's got a new book out on leadership.
I saw that, yeah.
One of the things that he's talking a lot about now is diversity and you know, having a conversation that says not only is it the right thing, sort of, I don't know if these are his exact words, so, but from a moral perspective, from a human being to human being perspective, but he makes the case, as many others have as well, that you build stronger companies, you build stronger institutions when you have a collection of folks with different backgrounds and perspectives and so forth and so on. And so what I love is, you know, here is a lauded leader of our country coming forward and declaring this, right? And so I see these things as hugely positive. And so do you think in our lifetime, Christian, that we will get to a place where, whether it's leaders of hospitals or government institutions or businesses, and it's like this notion of social diversity and a fairness regardless of fill in your blank.
Right. Background. I think we're beginning to see the leading companies do that, right? So there are companies that say, hey, we're not just going to talk about gender equality. We're going to make sure that women are represented at every level in our company in the proper ratios. Right?
Did you see that Governor Brown made it law in California that public companies who are in California have to have at least one female director?
Right. That's very important. And in Europe, public companies have to also have an employee on their board.
So, oh, interesting, to represent the employee perspective.
That's right. So you have to have, in other words, you can't just fire everybody at the first drop of a hat, you know, because that's how you keep you and then get paid an extra bonus because you laid everybody off. And here's your $25 million GM, GM's Mary Ibarra, or the guy from Sears, you know, who's basically destroying Sears and pocketing all this money as a bonus.
The other one, and of course, I don't want to break my own thing about a political discussion, but when all of the why am I blanking on his name? The latest Supreme Court Justice
Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Brett Kavanaugh. Right. When all that was going on, I thought the entire media missed the big point. And the big point to me is, why are we electing a dude?
Right.
Right. If there's nine. There should be a law that says minimum of four need to be women. And I don't know if you've seen it. There's a great Netflix documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
I have not seen that. I do mean to see it, though.
You'll love it. It's called The Notorious RBG.
Yeah.
And it's awesome. And there's a legendary quote in there where a reporter asks her, you know, something to the effect of, when will you stop crusading for women judges and women on the Supreme Court? And what do you think is the right number of women on the Supreme Court? And she says, when there are nine.
Right. That's funny.
And my wife has a workout yoga t-shirt
that says when there are nine. Well, actually, there's some truth to the fact that women, and if you look at the Nordic capitalism, you know, in the Nordic countries, you know, Norway, Finland, they have more women in government than men. And it's because, you know, they're more progressive, and the women in some ways, John Hegel has argued that the way women view the world is much more nurturing and has a much more broader view and a wider sort of inclusiveness than sort of this male, let's beat up our, are we done? Are we out of time?
No, I was just making sure my phone wasn't beeping or whatever. We're not, we'll go as long as we want, Christian.
I don't know what you're going to do with this again. You know, I guess next, you know, this is going all over the map. But the idea is that women have a longer time scale and a much, you know, and of course this is not to be stereotypical because there are women who don't, you know, women who behave just like men.
Yes, of course.
And vice versa. But the idea of diversity, look at food, okay? There was a joke the other day on one of these talk shows where the guy says, well, if you don't like diversity, then you shouldn't be allowed, if you don't like Mexicans, then you shouldn't be allowed to eat Mexican food. and that's funny, but if you really think about it, you know, food is sort of the barrier that crosses boundaries. If you really think about it, you know, Chinese food, Mexican food, we love to eat you know, the world's
yes,
food.
We sure do.
We sure do, right? It makes life much more
Thai
happy.
Food is incredible.
Fun.
I love Greek, you know, I love
right.
Mediterranean food.
Right.
I used to spend a lot of time in.
You don't have to stick to one of them. You eat them all. You try, enjoy them all. Some things you like, some you won't. But you know, this the idea that we have just one kind of food and it's porridge and that's what you're going to eat every day and live your life in a bowl of porridge. Well, what kind of world is that? And America, of all countries, was built on immigrants. I mean, some were forced to come here at the bottom of slave ships, and others, you know, immigrated. How are we turning our backs on? And, you know, we don't even have an immigrant problem. We actually don't. I mean, immigrants in Silicon Valley, there's all those stats about how many jobs have been created by these immigrant entrepreneurs.
Listen, I've been in Silicon Valley for 2 or 4 years, somewhere in there. And I would guess, it's just my gut. I'd have to go back and detail it to be more analytical. But my gut is minimum 60% of the entrepreneurs I've worked with are not Native American born. And it might be even higher than that. I mean, it is incredible. And of course, I'm an immigrant, as are you.
Right.
And to get back to the food, this is going to get me in trouble, you know, as a guy with Scottish heritage. But like, hey, Scotland,
enough with the haggis.
England, yeah. Ireland, look, yeah. Not so much on your food. You know whose food I like? I'm married to an Italian. Let's
right.
talk about Italian food, right? Right? Like, let's eat the good food. And to your point on Mexican,
yeah.
You know, the greatest thing or what? The one of the greatest things about living in California is the Mexican food is incredible.
Amazing. Yeah.
Well, whether it's a taco truck or a high-end place or.
Yeah. I was standing in the line at a grocery store in England about, you know, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, watching these old British people dressed in, you know, Mr. Bean tweed-like outfits and stuff.
Yeah.
Very, very British. This old lady and this old guy were, you know, emptying their cart onto the conveyor belt there to check
yeah.
out. And I was really interested because they were buying food, right? So I was like, let me see what these guys are eating. Everything they had in there was some radical Indian food. You know, it was nothing British.
Yes.
Everything was Indian. And I was like, wow.
And I got to tell you, I love Indian food.
And it was sort of a, you know, Empire Strikes Back kind of moment, you know, where I was like, well, we conquered them with our food. That's what we
totally.
Did.
Totally. And yeah. I'll give you a line I heard years ago from Indian food purveyor at a farmer's market. And he was sort of, you know, how some guys at farmer's markets will bark things out to get people to come over and taste something and try
right.
something. And they have their little routines that they do. And
right.
this guy had a bunch of them. But my favorite one that he used to say is, you got to eat your samosas like you're supposed to. And if you don't like a good samosa, I don't know, maybe something's wrong with you. I don't know how healthy they are, but man, they're not
that healthy. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, chutney. Oh, yeah. God.
Well, this is the problem, right? We all like
on.
Fried stuff. So what's ended up, even with all these ethnic foods, everything has to be fried. Everything has sugar, too much sugar in it. And it's fried. So those are the two sort of cardinal sins of eating. But, you know,
you should
still eat
your samosas like you're supposed to.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with social activism. Let's go through the list.
Yeah, so then you have workplace activism about governance, how is your corporation organized, how you treat your employees, labor and union relations, supply chain management, how green is your supply chain, how do you govern, how do you pay, or are you paying a living wage? And of course, CEO pay, you know, which is huge. And to me, the problem with CEO pay is exactly why we're in this place. Because when you have CEOs becoming a class unto themselves, you have created this super separation. Income inequality begins and ends, I think, with the explosion in CEO pay. Because if you look at the chart of how CEO pay sort of exploded, and you look at income inequality exploding, they track each other really closely. In fact, they track each other almost, you know, and I can't say for sure, of course, but there's a correlation, but I think there is.
So I'm kind of with you on, the social part of me is with you that some of this is ridiculous. You know, who needs to make $200 million a year?
That's right.
But
and if they do, why can't we tax them? You know, because America's wealthiest period, if you look at back to the, when America was great, okay, let's just say in the 50s we were great, even though we had some real issues, CEOs were taxed at 90%. If you made above, you know, the 1% were taxed at 90%. Eisenhower, even up to Reagan, were taxed at 80%. It was after Reagan that we, you know, got our tax cuts and these guys stopped paying taxes.
So let me nudge on this one. And I really want to have a thoughtful, and you're the right guy to have this conversation with. So I get that. And the flip side in my head, of course, is, well, free market enterprise, man.
Right. You know, so this is a good question. In fact, you know, it's probably our next book.
We just had Andre Iguodala from the Warriors, MVP of the finals, three-time champion. I don't know exactly what he makes, but, you know, he makes some giant amount of money. LeBron James makes a giant amount of money and
right.
you know, all these guys, right? And
right.
so free market enterprise.
But does the coach make that money? See, here's the thing. Does Stephen Kerr make the same money as LeBron James? No.
No.
And that's the problem with American companies. The CEO makes more than this, than the, you know, and who is the star in an American company? It's the guys who innovate, the knowledge worker. Hmm. The middle class
so
is actually the star.
We have the emphasis in the wrong place.
Yes. Well, it's not even emphasis. We know where it should be, but we are starving our middle class so that a few people can make a lot of money. This is not an accidental thing.
And then let me push on the tax thing. So,
sure.
you know, I'm somebody who pays 60% tax. So I work for Uncle Sam until July, August.
Right. Why is that? Right.
And I also think I want to live in a system that provides incentives, carrots, for being successful, for being innovative, for doing new important shit that makes a difference.
Sure.
And so how do we, and it's all about where and how we draw the lines, right? How do we, on one hand, I don't want to see corporations and I don't want to be involved with fucking over employees
right.
and not allowing a middle class. I think you should have a strong middle class. I think developers and salespeople have gotten fucked over in an interesting way in Silicon Valley in the 20 plus years that I've been here. We talk about how that is. I think there's been a real stock option fuck job done to the sort of frontline person, even in the tech industry. And so how do we, if we're going to think about workplace activism, how do we on one level create the incentives for people to want to strive to do legendary things, to move up the corporate ladder and do that, and at the same time have a heart and have some.
Well, it's very simple. Why in the biggest democracy in the world, we think we're democratic people, right? But how come all our companies are run as totalitarian states? And the reason is they're not run because that's the most profitable way to run a company for the guys on the top, right? It's the Genghis Khan model because Genghis Khan gets all the stuff. It's an aristocracy, if you will.
But at the same time, if we said, hey, man, let's everybody's equal, come to work and do whatever the fuck you want. And
no, I'm not saying
nobody
that.
Nobody can make it. Like,
I'm not
so,
saying
yeah,
that.
Yeah, where's
but,
the, how do we, what's the
right.
new model?
Okay, so let's look at the new model. The model probably comes, the best models that you see for this stuff is, I'll go to soccer for a second, okay? And you look at the teams, and the best performing teams in the world of soccer are Real Madrid and Barcelona right now, for a few years now. They've been that way. What kind of companies are they? Well, they're public companies, but they're owned by members of the community. They're not they're not owned by an American tycoon like Manchester United.
Right. They're essentially owned by the fans, are they not?
They're owned by the fans and members. You know, so so it's almost like a co-op.
Yeah.
And these guys then decide who's going to be they vote for the managers, they vote for the guy who's in charge, and then that guy who's the executive, you know, gets paid pretty well, but he's not looting the company, right? He can't loot the company because he doesn't have that power. So it's a matter of where we give the power.
It's interesting. So my buddy Mike Maples Jr. of Floodgate Capital, he essentially says corporations as we know them today
are gone. Yes.
And the model that he sees coming forward are networks.
Yes. And they're networks and cooperatives. That's right. It's collaborative capitalism. Okay. That's the next thing.
And sort of the economic value gets spread around the network, and certain certain nodes in the network are more valuable than others. And
that's right.
But
and it's almost like a community, right? When you, so let's just say you have a soccer team. Like when you were playing, let's say baseball or football, whatever it is you're playing in your neighborhood when you were kids, because now nobody does that. But you'd go for a pickup game, right? You'd go to play. Well, yeah. And you had two teams. You'd have two pretty good players who would pick the rest of the team, and you'd split people, right? So you'd start off by picking the most valuable people, right?
Yes.
You say, hey, I want this guy on my team, that guy, blah, blah. But it's not like one guy decides, well, I got all the best guys, and you have all the crappy players on your team.
Yeah, so that you are right in that the hierarchies and the distribution of value, if I could maybe put it that way,
that's called a monopoly,
are kind of more organic in that sense, right?
Yeah, and the best players, called a monopoly. See, so if I had the power, if I had a gun and said, hey, my team is going to be only the top 10 players here are all on my team and nobody else gets anybody, and I have a gun to enforce that, then I'm rigging the system, as they say, to basically say that my company rules the roost and nobody else can innovate because I've taken everything.
So the company of the future looks more like a cooperative and less like a dictatorship.
That's right. And okay. And it's going to have to, if we're going to survive. Otherwise, we have two alternatives. You've seen what's happening in China, right? So China is a warning for where we're headed, which is you've got that social score thing going on where they're tracking every citizen.
It's so fucking crazy, and we have to rat each other out. And it's like, it really is, it's like Facebook and George Orwell had a baby.
That's right.
Right?
That's right. But then add to that the fascist element, which says, if you don't believe what we believe, then we put you in a concentration camp where we're going to give you harmonious re-education. That's what they're doing.
Yeah, I'm sure it's
very harmonious.
The Western
side with the Muslims, they've got 1.5 Muslims sitting in jail, basically, listening to videos of the great leader and how, you know, Islam is bad and forcing them to eat pork. This is not how you, you know, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
And you could just easily see that kind of system being transferred over to, let's say, a country here that has lost its democracy and is run by a fascist sort of government with the technology that we want. And we're pretty close to it already, actually.
So
closer
we've got
than
social,
we think.
We've got workplace. What's the next one?
Political activism. So, you know how people say, oh, we don't want to be involved in politics. Well, the truth is, all these companies are involved in politics and they've been lobbying, you know, forever. I mean, the whole reason why nothing happens in Washington is because of lobbyists. So this political activism, unlike Canada, where companies can't actually contribute to individual candidates.
That's right.
How simple is that? You know,
That's
if you're Exxon, you can't contribute to the prime minister's campaign.
You know, it's so funny to me. Why can't we do this? The answers to some of these questions are really clear, right? If you take money out of politics in the United States, you take corporations.
That's right.
Then shit changes, right?
Everything changes.
It's like
in fact,
the Catholic
that's
Church,
the whole point.
You know, to say something controversial.
Right.
If the Catholic Church just said, okay, first of all, if you did that bad shit, you're out. And you probably, you know, go to jail, right? So, boom, all the bad guys are gone. And we immediately decree, A, priests can marry, women are priests, 50% of priests need to be women at such and such date,
every
and
level.
50% of bishops and our leadership need to be women by such and such a date, period, full stop, end of discussion.
Right.
The minute you do that, you're done, right?
The problem with power, so this comes back to power. Who has the power and who's ready to give up power? Nobody's ready to give up power. No dictator says, oh, I have lots of power, take it. The only exception to this rule is like the king of Bhutan, right, who shared power because, you know, he's interested in his happiness index over there in Bhutan. But even there, there's a hidden secret, which is Bhutan is actually an ethnic, sort of one-dimensional ethnic majority, and they got rid of their minorities in various ways.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, and maybe I'm just a naive idiot, but in my own life, I've had different types of power, right? And so I've had what you could call positional power.
Right.
And there's real things that come with positional power, the ability to spend money and hire and fire people and promote people. And, you know, there's real, when you're a senior executive, there's real things you can point to.
Right. And people come after you and kiss your butt for no reason.
Because
that you
of all
can
that
imagine,
stuff.
Yeah.
In my life now, I have zero positional power. And the only quote unquote power that I have is my ability to communicate with people, to interact with people, my ideas.
But you have a reputation.
Yes, and that's wonderful. And so here's what I'm trying to say. I love not having any positional power, and I love knowing that when I walk into any kind of a room, the only thing that's going to work is the way I engage with people and the quality of my ideas and so forth.
Right.
That to me is way more interesting than positional
power. And what you're describing is a meritocracy, right? Where people who are naturally have natural talents rise to the top and get the, you know, and are sort of, and in a way you could say sports, right? Your football team, your basketball team is the best example of that. Right, you can come from anywhere. You have the talent. You score the goals. You make it. You get paid really well because you're contributing to the performance of that team.
Yes.
Well, the problem with government is, and this is why, you know, people say, "Oh, you got to run the government like a business." We talk about this in the book as well. So when you say you want to run the government like a business, you're actually lying through your teeth because you can't do it because no business caters to everybody in that
country.
That's
right. You can't tell a customer of government to go F itself, and you can't favor certain customers over others.
And that's what a business is, right? We choose who our target customer audience is, and we target our sort of solution to meet the needs of that audience. Well,
there's
government,
a word you don't hear as much as I think you used to, and that word is service.
Right. Okay, see, I've anticipated this. Okay, here's the book everybody needs to read.
The Call of Service. That was a very, very powerful thing. Robert Coles.
Yeah.
Yes.
Robert Coles is this genius guy. He's 90-something years old now, I think. One of our best psychologists. But if you think about public service, right, and the guy's supposed to, you know, our public officials are supposed to be public servants.
Yes.
Our private officials, like the corporate CEO, if he's practicing servant leadership, is supposed to be a private servant.
I love this term. Chris Brogan uses this term all the time.
Yes.
And you know, it's interesting. I have some dear friends who are firefighters, fire chiefs, police officers, and it's not bullshit either. I've spent a lot of time, you know, we had TJ Welsh on the podcast. Who's an incident commander. He's retired now, but an incident commander in California and, you know, responsible for you know, he can put up a city and the supply lines required for 5,000 firefighters to fight a fire within 6 to 8 hours. I mean, an incredible set of capabilities that these guys can deliver. And this man, by way of example, is so deeply rooted in wanting to serve. That's where he gets.
So how come we don't have those guys as our politicians? How come those guys aren't getting to be president? How come those guys? Because what you see is we reward the wrong kind of person, and our system is set up to reward the wrong. Because this guy that you're talking about is not going to spend all his time kissing ExxonMobil's butt or the Koch brothers' butt to get their money so he can run for election. He's going to go help the poor.
You know, to your point, there's a provocative idea that some smart people have that I'm beginning to think is really smart. Sebastian Younger was on the podcast, and he shared about this. And General McChrystal said very similar things, which is at 18 years old in the United States, you should have to do at least 1 year of service to the country.
He's right. He's really right, because what has happened is we have created an upper class that has no connection to the struggles of the rest of the country, and that's why we should have a draft. If we had a draft, all of a sudden we wouldn't be in all these wars, because rich kids won't be going everywhere every 5 minutes with their rich parents allowing them to run off to the war. And of course, you have draft deferments like our president right now and all his staff and even previous Republican staffs, basically everybody were chicken. All of those guys were chicken hawks. None of them ever served.
And what Sebastian says, and I think McChrystal said it too, is it doesn't necessarily need to be military. Maybe you serve Habitat for Humanity and you build homes, or maybe you do, I don't, you know, there's different things you can go do.
And maybe it's all of the above. Maybe you get to do all of them, and then you can decide, hey, if you want to be in the army, go do that. But The problem is we have created, and capitalism does this because it rewards only one thing. And that's
okay. So I want to make sure we get through the list because I am going to run out of time. So
yeah, no, we're almost out of time.
Political. What's the next one?
Environmental, which is pretty simple, right? Basically, we're pretty much at the end of the rope here, you know, with the methane that started being released. I mean, that's the real problem now on top of the carbon dioxide is the methane that's escaping from the tundra. So you have ecocide, basically where the environment, you know, you're destroying the ecosystem completely. And, you know, this guy in Brazil, you know, who's decided that he's going to exploit the Amazon and chop down the Amazon, Bolsonaro, disaster. I mean, this is not a disaster for Brazil. It's a disaster for the whole planet. Okay, then you have economic activism, which is things like taxes, wages, redistribution. How do you redistribute wealth? How do you, you know, what are your how do you solve the problem of inequality? And legal, which is, again, employment laws, citizenship, what are the laws and policies that you... So one example is privacy, right? We've just talked about how there is no real effective privacy law. So all of a sudden, here's... So I'll give you another example of how employees become activists. So in Google, right, we saw employees stand up.
Say NFW, right? You don't get to do that.
You don't get to do that. You can't go do AI and join the Pentagon and start being part of the kill chain because Google's interested in not being evil, right? Yeah. The good thing here is Google actually listened to its employees, and you can argue what level of listening they did, but at least they stopped doing the Pentagon thing. They said, okay, we're a consumer brand. We're not going to start doing the military stuff where we're using our AI to kill people. Yeah. We're not going to do that. Okay, with the sexism stuff, with that guy who ran off with his big bonus and, you know, the executive who got, I forgot his name now, but the
CBS guy or the... was there,
no, this is at Google again.
Oh, where, yeah. Shit.
He was one of the...
Rubenstein?
Why am I blanking on his name? Yeah, I'm a blank. But you get the point. This guy walks away with a giant package of compensation and all kinds of bonuses, and employees say that's not good. You know, we're not standing up for that. So Google has a problem. You know, but what you see,
Uber is probably an even bigger example of this, right?
Uber, absolutely.
Female engineer comes forward in a very courageous way, in my opinion,
right?
And ultimately ends up getting the founder.
That's right, getting rid
CEO
of
CEO out.
Yes. But what you see at Amazon is a more dangerous thing because they don't have freedom of thought or speech. It doesn't seem like at Amazon in the same way that they do. And so they're at Google. So you see a much
Rubin,
more.
That's his name. Andy Rubin.
Okay.
At Google.
Okay. So at Amazon, you have a much more sort of dictatorial system. And of course, it's driven by the personality of the CEO. But the question is, the CEO has too much power, and that's the problem. We just saw that at Nissan and Renault, where the CEO, Carlos Ghosn, just had like $40 million he was embezzling from the company, something like that, you know, to buy houses and stuff. So the question becomes:
these rich guys who have more money than they can ever spend, like do
why
this
do they
stuff?
Have to
it's
keep
like,
going?
Why are you
right?
doing this? It's like what
because they've gotten disconnected from reality. That's what happens, and reality. And this is the problem. Where's the shared, you know, when Michael Porter says we need shared values, right? And we have shared values. Well, there are no shared values between the Koch brothers and the guy in the street, although they've been duped into thinking that liberty is a shared value. But liberty has a cost. And what the Koch brothers' version of liberty is, I'm free to rape the planet. That's my liberty. Take your money and make as much money as I can and leave everybody destitute. That's my freedom. Well, that's not how it works in society because civilization says that, you know, as soon as you get these income inequality goes beyond a certain boundary, you're going to have two things, war or totalitarianism and fascism. That's what happens. So you know, on the right.
The one thing I will say, there's a very fascinating interview with on Freakonomics with one of the Koch brothers. And it to me it de-demonized him somewhere.
Right. Well, that's they're working hard to do that. They have a very interesting
point of view. I don't know that I want to defend the Koch brothers. It's not necessarily what I'm trying to do, but I'm not sure it's quite as black and white, but I understand exactly what you're saying.
Well, so it comes down to outcomes. You know, America today is in trouble, you know, like, and it has to do, I mean, it's like these, okay, here's National Geographic, right? One of the big articles in here is from Jared Diamond. You know, here's sort of the biggest problem in the world today.
The global peril of inequality. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's it. I mean, when you don't have a middle class, all bets are off. You no longer have the American.
And this is, you know, one of the interesting things I find about America. People here protesting the 1%. It's like, oh, yeah. You do know that virtually everybody in the United States of America is in the 1%. And they say, well, what
globally.
Do you mean?
That's right.
Globally.
Right.
And then they get all twisted up and sideways.
Well, the point, yeah, that's true, but even that's changing, and that's part. I mean, we have hollowed out our middle class, and you know, we were going back to these. You know how we were saying, hey, if we could just take money out of politics and create sort of a system where servant leaders become politicians, right? People who actually heed the call of service. Well, then what happens? Well, that's what we're saying Bill Gates needs to spend his money on. We have a letter to Bill Gates at the end of this thing where we say, hey, Bill, you know, all this money you're spending all over the place, that's great, and we commend you for it. But the minute you sort of...
Unbelievable, in my opinion.
Yeah, it is unbelievable. But what he should be doing with his money, if he wants lasting change, is basically fix democracy in America. Because without that, we have lost not just America and the U.S., but we have lost sort of the hope of democracy for the future, because democracy is in retreat right now. It's a bad time for democracy. Everywhere we go, we have the rise of populism. And that's why this yellow jacket thing is very interesting, because for the first time, you have the left and the right coming together to basically take on government and say, you know, you need to pay attention to us and not the donor class and the millionaire class, which is what Michael Porter says.
I think if people in America don't pay attention to what's going on in France and the UK right now.
No, but this is spreading. Exactly. And Bernie Sanders is part of that. I mean, in fact, you know, Steve Bannon, right? He has this global movement that he calls the movement to basically, you know, pick on immigrants, create this nationalistic sense of destroy the EU. I mean, he's basically doing a lot of damage. And these guys on the other side, you have Yanis Varoufakis, the ex-Greek finance minister, people like Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn. And their idea is, look, the EU is messed up, but we need to fix it so it serves the people. Government needs to serve the people and the public interest. That's it. And so...
And Christian, I think on that note, we need to kick out of this wave.
Thanks, man.
I have a call at 3 o'clock.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what happened. Yeah,
I love you. You know, I don't know that I agree with every word that comes out of your mouth, but you know what? I love your brain, man. I love hanging out with you. You're one of my favorite people.
I really appreciate your
writing. I appreciate your passion and your commitment and your friendship.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. I look forward to chatting with you again. And listen, I hope we come back more regularly.
We need to do something different next time, man. We need to structure it a little bit. Yeah.
Thank you, brother.
Thanks, man. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Whew. Christian Sarkar, back on the podcast. I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. I love that guy. He's awesome. Now, for some reason you want to email us, we're trying to get the Q&A episodes going again. You can send email to blackhole@lockhead.com. If for some bizarre reason you want to follow me on Twitter and or Instagram, I'm @lockhead. All right. We would like to thank the legendary Christian Sarkar. Check him out at christiansarkar.com. That's and his last name is spelled Sarkar. TheMarketingJournal.org, what legendary marketing people read. Check it out. Niche Down, How to Become Legendary by Being Different, the Amazon #1 bestseller. Verve Coffee, the leader in West Coast craft coffee and the official coffee of Christopher Lockhead, Follow Your Different, in beautiful Santa Cruz, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Tokyo, and always on the web at vervecoffee.com. OneLifeFullyLived.org, one of my favorite nonprofits. Check it out. We help you dream, plan, and live your best life. You looking to design and dominate a new category? Why not check out Category Design Advisors at CategoryDesignAdvisors.com. Now, are you wearing boring socks? Is it time for something different? Why not check out John's Crazy Socks, my favorite socks. It's one of the greatest episodes of Legends and Losers, episode 155. If you go to lockhead.com and type in John's Crazy Socks in the search bar, you'll get that episode with John Cronin and Mark Cronin. Now, are you feeling a little whelmed in an undersense well? I don't know. Do you need some help? Why not leverage the power of a virtual assistant with Bottleneck Virtual Assistants at bottleneck.online. And Habitat for Humanity is a great nonprofit working hard for a world where everybody has a decent home. Check them out at habitat.org. All right, I need to remind you that this Oddcast is the sole property of the Lockhead Oddcast Network, and all rights do remain perturbed. We must warn you that clearly this Oddcast was produced by people who consume libations. Teach marketing. Support your local CMO. Don't forget to save water and shower with a friend. We do have a water crisis going on here in California. I don't feel tardy. If you haven't changed your mind lately, how do you know you have one? Thank you, Candy Dandy. I love you, Mom and Dad. And hey, Colin, this Oddcast really ties the room together, doesn't it? Today, our deepest apologies go out to Dr. Larry Nassar. Sorry, Lar. We just ran out of time for you. That's it, my friends. Thank you so much. I deeply appreciate you investing part of your life with me. And until next time, follow your different.